listening to the All Caps Podcast, episode 56 for the week of Monday, December 20th, 2010. In this episode, we discuss coupons, old people with holstered circulars, drugstore toys turning to ash, a post-worker delivering mail in the nude, a $286 million credit card bill, the most annoying words, top Twitter trends, Facebook and diaspora, Age of Odds, Teen Wolf penis, schizophrenia, wrestling, steel cages, Royal Rumbles, ECW and the death of wrestling, tugboat, K-Pax, and much more. For more information, please visit www.allcastpodcast.com.
I need to talk to you, Julio. I need to tell you something very important, man to man, okay? You listening?
Yes, sir.
This world, it's a dark, dark forest. If you open up a man and look into most of their hearts, you'll find disgust and evil. You hear me?
Yes, sir.
Your own parents, your mother and father, would slit your throat just to get ahead. And when you find a wife, you watch her. You don't believe a single word she says, because at the core, people are shit. The only person that you can trust is me, your Taekwondo instructor.
Podcast, your source for news, politics, culture, all righties. I'm one of your hosts, Henry, and podcasting on it doesn't do that.
And I'm your other host, Chris, about to get a new truck.
All right, so we were talking just seconds ago, and I instantly started the podcast. I didn't have a rant, but you just got me fired up. Fucking old people at supermarkets and anywhere they go, they always have an arsenal of coupons. And they're constantly arguing over about the value of those coupons, if it got charged, if the item is the item's on said coupon, if it's expired or not. Here's the thing about coupons, people. They're bullshit. They don't save anybody money. What coupons do, coupons are just like sales that you see at stores. Mm-hmm. They're not saving anybody money. They're trying to shift you over to brand name items.
Right.
For a brief period of time, they're not saving you money. They're making you spend a little bit more than you'd spend on the non-name brand item.
Exactly.
But you think you're saving money because you're spending a reduced price on the name brand item. They're bullshit. Spending your time cutting them out, collecting them, finding and applying them is a total waste of your time, and you're being manipulated. Old people, you morons, die already.
I know, and this was prompted by the, just like we were talking about before we hit record, it was prompted because I was at CVS, and I'll go on the record as saying the CVS I go to is probably the worst in the country. they simply do, they're not attentive to their customers. All I ask is that they give me some basic eye contact. They stop what they're doing when, you know, I'm not saying that they have to drop everything and wait on me, but waiting, I will sometimes stand there and wait for them to come to me for 10 minutes. And I'm the kind of guy who, like, I don't want to become like these old people. So I won't even be like, hey, can I get any help over here? Like, I don't even bring attention to myself because that's what these old fucks do. And I'm trying so hard to prevent myself from becoming one of them. But I'm standing there in line today, and, like, the first person in line is an old person who's getting into an argument with the pharmacy as though they have any fucking power to manipulate Medicare or, you know, whatever they, like, as if the pharmacy can do anything with this. This person's arguing with them about the price of their prescriptions, and all the pharmacy is they're just in an exchange point. You know, they just simply hand over what you've got, and what the system tells them to charge is what they charge you. That's it. They're a middleman, and they have no influence on whether or not your prices go up and down. Now, they can contact your insurance provider, I think, or actually, no, you. I've been in this situation. I had to contact my insurance. They had to give a waiver. Then it had to go through the system and reach CVS's system so that when they filled it, it didn't ring up as the costlier price. Anyway, that douchebag gets done, and in front of me is this broad who's buying every fucking grocery under the sun. There's a different line for that, you dumb broad.
Yeah, they think they're gaming the system by going to the pharmacy line.
I mean, I'll bring a few items with me, but I sort of have an under 10 items policy. I won't stack up my fucking cart of groceries, which, who does their groceries at CVS anyway? But if there's convenience items...
And who does their... Have you ever noticed people doing their Christmas shopping at CVS?
Oh,
and, those and, poor kids!
And what's sadder, though, than the fact that CVS actually now... Like, I feel like in their marketing department, they're kind of like, yeah, I mean, this could be sales, but God, we have to market this shitty merchandise somehow. So I go into the store today and they're blasting this music. It's not even Christmas music, and not that I care, but it's not even flavored for the season. It's just like, like coming out of speakers over by the wine / ice cream area. And they're fucking trying to market this, you know, $49.99, get state-of-the-art speakers. I just imagine old people seeing this, and they're like, wow, we can become part of the 21st century with these, you know, like really getting into that shit. So yeah, people do that stupid Christmas shopping. CVS, look, CVS is good for three things: lotto tickets, Halloween candy, and your prescriptions. End of story. Don't buy anything else from there. Don't muck up the lines. Jesus Christ.
The toys at CVS, they're so... it's as if they are designed to be as shitty as possible. And I imagine kids opening up their presents, getting the CVS toy, and it disintegrating in their hands like it's made out of ash.
Yeah, it's like they open up their GoBots ripoff. Not even a Transformers ripoff, a GoBots ripoff. They open it up and it doesn't even flex at certain joints. It just stands still. You know, there's no value to it. And God, just the shit that I see. Anyway, it's all just knickknacks and horrible shit you can probably get for cheaper at a dollar store anyway. But then the old broad, she brings out her circular. That's the other thing.
They wear holsters with circulars
in them.
I know.
she's just constantly, every item that's rung up, she's pointing. Like, she strategically purchased every item within that circular. Like, she's actually probably depriving herself of basic nutrients. She's simply buying sour cream because it's in the circular. Not because she needs it. Not because it's going to go on top of something that she's even buying. She can't afford anything to put the sour cream on. She's simply buying sour cream that she's probably spoon feeding into her fat, fucking disgusting. Sting ass old fucking husband who's dying of rage and wants a divorce so badly and just wants somebody to suck his cock one last time before he croaks of some fucking geriatric disease we'll all succumb to one day. My God.
All right, let's move on. Well, first of all, reminder about the All Caps Gathering, December 23rd in the Detroit area. Email allcapspodcast@gmail.com for the location. We're saying about an 8 p.m. start time, and we'll record a live show and all that business. It should be fun. Let's move on to the news.
News, news, news.
The motherfucking news.
All right, I need a breather. I am dying right now. All right, so because of the way the tide has turned, I will not be bringing up the tide has turned in favor of me wanting to be pissed. So I will not bring up the fact that Obama has signed a tax deal that we were talking about on the last podcast, and that's being hailed as a bipartisan effort that is not at all amicable to the nation's middle class or poor. I won't be talking about that. What I want to talk about is funny stuff this week. The past few weeks, we've been pretty heavy with the news. So this week, this happened in Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. A postal worker was arrested after delivering the mail naked, and the Wisconsin postal carrier said he simply wanted to cheer up a woman on his rounds who seemed, quote, stressed out when he decided to deliver the mail in the buff. But upon further review, the worker told police that delivering mail while completely naked probably wasn't a good idea. Probably not that great of an idea to do that. A police report says the 52-year-old man told the woman he would deliver the mail in the nude to her office in Whitefish Bay to make her laugh. The report says that on December 4th, he brought the mail wearing only a smile. Fucking new the Associated Press. It's got to be newspaper hell working for them to come up with this shit. Just to make themselves amused. The mail carrier was arrested for lewd and lascivious behavior several days later. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says the man admitted delivering the mail naked was a stupid thing to do. I think if mail carriers delivered the mail nude, that it would increase. Well, I guess it depends on. never mind. I'm going to recant what I was about to say, which is I would like to see nude mail carriers, but then I thought about every mail carrier I've ever known and how they're not hot at all. Scratch that. Have you ever seen a hot mail carrier?
No, I think it's a statistical impossibility.
I'm going to Google it.
what's really impressive about this, though, is that this is Wisconsin in the winter.
I know.
That guy's penis must have been like an acorn set inside a beanbag.
There are sexy mail carrier videos you can look up, by the way. Just check it out. They're there. All right, let's push ahead on this. You think you're in debt? This is me embellishing a bit just to make the story better because it's fucking stupid. Woman sues after $287 million credit card bill. This coming out of Philadelphia, PA. A Pennsylvania woman's lawsuit against Capital One claims she was harassed for months over an erroneous $286,651,237 credit card bill. The Philadelphia court lawsuit filed by Patrice Perry, 58, alleges the company used, quote, terroristic debt collection methods, unquote, while dunning her family members and coworkers for months to collect on an erroneous debt, the Philadelphia Daily News reported Tuesday. Craig Kimmel, Perry's attorney, said Capital One first sent an erroneous bill for $4,807 in May 2009, and the amount the bank claimed she owed fluctuated wildly between months. Quote, it's not your typical scenario where you'd expect if you were pursing debt with interest, it would only go up, Kimmel said. It went down and up and down and up. The only thing I can associate with that is that they were trying to confuse my client. The suit is seeking $286,651,237, the same amount Capital One claimed Perry owed. Isn't that ballsy? It's like, I love that she thinks she's entitled. Her stress is clearly not worth $286 million. You know what kind of stress is worth $286 million? Is standing in line behind a fat fucking old lady at fucking CVS. That's worth a lawsuit of $286 million. Not being erroneously billed that amount. Come on, lady. Like, she should maybe get 50 cents.
Story is so odd because clearly it was just a clerical error or something.
Right.
So you would imagine this to have just been cleared up very, very quickly with a phone call where she says, you know, you're harassing me about this bill, but look at the number on the bill. It's clear. And they'd be like, oh, we're sorry, let's get this worked out. Instead, this escalates into her saying that they were terrorizing her about this bill, and then she's counters. How is this actual problem solving taking place?
Imagine taking the phone call. You're just a shitty, you know, a phone service representative for Capital One, probably, you know, a contractor for them, not even really working for them. And you receive the call and you see that number and you go, well, clearly this is wrong. I'll take care of this or I'll elevate this issue. I don't understand how it got this far, where the confusing my client portion of this comes in, and why it's worth reparations of equal value to the erroneous number put on the statement. It makes no sense.
It seems to me like this woman used this, saw like this is a potential gold mine, like I'm going to let this go. And I'm going to let them keep calling me and harassing me. And then I'm going to throw it back on them. She could have just easily called them up.
It was easily rectifiable. And I don't know how it escalated on either end. Really, I mean, Capital One should have nipped this one real quick.
How awesome would it be, though, if they did issue credit cards with no limit just to regular people? So you could just see how much debt people would get into.
How amazing would that be, though, if that happened and you literally were just like, well, time to declare bankruptcy after having lived an extravagant and amazing life.
You live the life of a millionaire on a Capital One credit card. Or everyone just gets together and says, let's just fuck Capital One. Everyone start charging millions.
Yeah.
And the country just implodes. Everyone's driving around in like stretch Rolls Royces with top hats.
All right. Let's move on. What do you think, to you, in the English language, what is the most irritating word that you hear? You might hear a lot, actually, because you have students who are younger. And
yes, I know. I know what it is. It's conversate.
That's your.
There's two of them. Conversate, and the second one is nowadays, which most often gets said as nowadays. Those are the two that drive me fucking nuts. First of all, because conversate... It It's a classic example, and this is as a teacher of writing, what you often see with students is they think that good writing means using big words, and that's not the case at all. Like, really good writing is efficient and short and to the point. So they use conversate, which is a conjured word that makes no sense. When conversate can just easily be replaced
the end
with talk.
Yeah, or just put converse
in yeah.
the eight. There's no reason for it. I don't even think that's like a sound word. I don't know if conversate, because conversation, to have a conversation is to converse, not to conversate, right? Am I right about that? I mean, it just seems, I mean, maybe it's the word. I don't know. It just doesn't seem practical.
Yeah, see, the thing with, you know, of course, linguists have revealed that Ebonics is actually a more coherent and efficient language than, say, English. But conversate is not a good example of that, because it's not making the language more efficient at all.
Right.
It's making a longer word that serves the exact same purpose as talk or converse.
Right.
So it's really doing no work, and it's just idiotic. But and nowadays, I don't know why people are obsessed with that word.
Well, I hear it
all the time.
Don't they do that to a lot of words similar to that? Like, I think of the word anyway, and I think people say anyways, and I don't think that's correct either. I think it's just anyway, no S. I'm pretty sure that I'm right about that.
Yeah.
And that grates me. But the reality is,
that's a Midwestern thing in particular too. Like how people say Myers.
Myers. Yeah.
Myers.
Me too. I hate that. Because I make it a point. Like, it comes up in my brain because I hear it so often to pluralize Myers. But it's almost the way that people say Illinois sometimes, which kills me. I don't even know how you or it's, you know, it's almost like when people say library. I don't know if anyone else still says that.
They do.
How do you get through life never being corrected for that?
Someone on Twitter was saying that an academic at a conference was doing a presentation, and throughout the entire presentation was saying library.
Oh my God.
Which is,
I had a boss who couldn't say, this is when I worked at a party store, so we talked a lot about beers and liquors, and he couldn't say Labatt's. He would always say Lablats. Like, no matter what came out, it was always like, hey, can you get a case of Lablats? And it never came out. I don't understand how people don't, you know, how do you not self-correct that? At some point, you read the box and you say, there's no L here. And everyone else in my life doesn't say Lablats. So how do I rectify this? It's easy. I stop saying fucking Lablats. I say Labatt, you know? It just doesn't make sense. But you're wrong about what was voted most irritating word in the English language. The most irritating word was voted as whatever. The word whatever topped a Marist poll as the most annoying word or phrase in the English language. Nearly 39% of the 1,020 Americans that were questioned in the survey deemed it the most irritating word, followed by the word like, with 28%, and the phrase, you know what I mean, at 15%. I hate the phrase, you know what I mean. People tack that on at the end as though it's a summation of everything they've said, and it's not. I need clarification if you're going to say, you know what I mean, because I probably don't. You need to continue with the thought. Don't stop it with, you know what I mean. And if anyone remembers the episode where we were ousted by those right-wing asshole podcasters, C.L. Vugli would constantly say, you know what I mean. And I got sick of it listening to that shit. You know what I mean? Fucking crazy. Perhaps these words are introduced through popular culture, for example, movies, so they catch on, said Mary Azzoli of Marist. It has a lot to do with how accepted and how popular they become in everyday speech. Azzoli said words like whatever can be quite dismissive depending on how they are used. Quote, it's the way they are delivered and inherent in that delivery is a meaning. The phrase, to tell you the truth, and actually were also unnerving. So, to tell you the truth, one, and then the word actually as another. But for younger Americans aged 18 to 29, like was the word that annoyed them most. Like is something that people throw in also as just a placeholder. It's sort of the way, you know, it's lost.
It's similar to now, I think.
Exactly. And just like I just did there, I go, but see, I that's my affect. Don't borrow it. Because if you cheapen it, it will then become known, and I don't want that to happen. I want to be able to retain my shitty filler.
three more words that annoy me.
Go for it.
And these are, they all kind of go together, I think. Amazing.
Okay.
Amazing gets used all the fucking time. Passionate. Every time I ever hear someone say they're passionate about something, it's often ridiculous. And then genius.
Oh, yeah. Well, see,
genius, amazing, passionate. They all go together and they get used so frequently that they've lost all meaning. They become cliches almost.
Sort of how awesome is technically not describing anything that would be by the definition of awesome. Nothing, I would say 99% of all things described as awesome are technically very underwhelming compared to what the meaning of awesome is. So.
Well, you know, irregardless of that.
You asshole. Irregardless. Or what about unthaw? I hate unthaw. Because to unthaw something.
But what is that? How do you spell that?
UNTHAW.
I don't think I've ever heard that.
Oh, you've never heard? Okay, so people will say, can you unthaw the meat for me? Or, you know, basically they're saying, can you please thaw out this thing that's in the freezer or something that's frozen? But they'll say unthaw as if that means to defrost it or get it back to room temperature or ready to cook. Unthaw is actually telling them to put it back in the freezer. It's not correct English. You say, I would like to thaw this item.
I've never heard anyone use that, actually. So.
Yeah, I hear people say it all the time. That might be a Midwestern thing, too. Crazy how words... I mean, I don't mind... Having been in linguistics classes, one thing I took away is the fact that language should be a transformational thing. It needs to undergo constant revision and things like that, but... I also in some way feel almost conservative about that approach because it's like I feel like things really need to, and that's another thing I hate. I was saying it, but I hate when people say or write, I feel this is the way things should be. You should say, I think that. You don't quite feel it, you think it. Anyway, that's just my diatribe on that. Ay vey. I think at some point the language, you have to call it, you have to put up a barrier and say, this word stays. It does not get redefined as something. The French do it all the time, man. They're all about preservation of language to a fault, though. You know, they go crazy. Like, they actually...
And theirs is very ethnocentric and racist at times.
It's absolutely racist. Because it runs contrary to... mostly to people who are coming to the country as immigrants, which is unfortunate. But that's the whole point, I guess, of language, is that it has to become more efficient. Like you said, Ebonics is a much more efficient version of our language, gets rid of certain verbs and adverbs and adjectives. I mean, things just get weeded out so that they can say, you doing this, like they'll say, you call, instead of, hey, did you call? You know, it's way more efficient. You can transport the message much better, and that's what language is all about. Eventually, we're just going to get back to grunts, and they're going to indicate everything that we need to say.
That connects to this study that was recently released about Twitter, and Twitter use is, I think it was 8 to 10% more African-American and Latino-Americans than white Americans use Twitter. And really, I think that has a lot. If you notice the hashtags, I wrote an article about this, the hashtags are most often the top trending hashtags are usually predominantly African-Americans using them. And their Twitter use is actually more social and more frequent, and they have more followers and more participants. And I think that connects to the idea that the language within Black communities is more conducive to the Twitter style. Language, I think.
Well, I do find myself sometimes having to cut back. Like, I'll write something and then I have to go back and trim it down. I get rid of the excess because I often type excess words that don't need to be there. Most of them are descriptors that I think are funny, so I have to end up, you know, bringing it down. But the Twitter example you brought up actually brings me to my last news story, which is, maybe you've already read this, but do you know what the top 10 Twitters were this year?
You mean
tweets,
that
I should say.
Oh, the tweets, not
the trends. Yeah, the trends. Not the actual. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm gonna say Justin Bieber.
Okay.
Did Michael Jackson die this year?
Was I think that last he died. In, I don't. Isn't that fucked up that we don't? I think it was 2009 though, wasn't it?
Well, I know. I know Justin Bieber's got to be up there. I'm just gonna say Inception.
Okay.
Is up there. Let's say WikiLeaks.
Okay.
What were the other big news stories this year? I can't remember any.
Well, you
were any of those on there?
Yes, you've got Justin Bieber and Inception. In terms of overall top trends, Inception was number 3, and Justin Bieber was number 8. The top trend was actually the Gulf oil spill, which I'm kind of happy to see.
Oh,
I'm glad.
Yeah.
I'm glad people were talking about something that was much more relevant than Justin Bieber. The second one was the FIFA World Cup. That was actually kind of cool because for the first time, I think, even over Twitter, and I don't know, I wasn't on Facebook for this event, so maybe it took over there too, but I felt like on Twitter, there was actually a community that was built around the World Cup that was going on. And it was kind of interesting to see how those trends sort of united the world. So here we are in the face of Time Magazine picking Mark Zuckerberg as their man of the year. But I'm curious, will Twitter take it back from him? Will next year, will Twitter be bigger? I mean, to me, it brought more people together talking about the World Cup than Facebook might have done. But, you know,
at this point, I'm getting really depressed about Facebook because it just seems like a juggernaut.
It's going to be hard to kill this beast.
It's turning into, just like World of Warcraft is in games, yep. Facebook is turning it into in social media where it's almost too big to fail now.
Yeah. Well, it's gone to the lowest common denominator. So its appeal is mass instead of niche, however you want to say that word. That's another word I can't say. Niche, whatever. Let me continue. Number 4 was the Haiti earthquake. Number 5 was Vuvuzela, tying into the FIFA World Cup. Number 6 was the iPad. Number 7, the Google Android. Number 8, again, was Justin Bieber. Number 9, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. And number 10 was Popol Pau. Popol Pau. What?
Who? What?
I don't know. Pulpo, P-U-L-P-O, Paul, P-A-U-L. The Pope? I don't know. Is that just? I never saw any one of...
Oh, it's not... That's the octopus that predicted the World Cup games.
So 3 of the top 10 trends was dealing with the World Cup.
Which is interesting because that shows that it sort of de-Americanizes Twitter. You know, those would not have trended if they were purely Americanized trending topics.
Not at all. And just to we'll link all of the results because they break it down also by news events, people, movies. I'll give you the top of each one. Again, news events was a Gulf oil spill. People, Justin Bieber beat out everyone else. Movies was Inception. Television was the MTV Music Awards. Technology was the iPad. The World Cup was its own category. Sports was LeBron James. But then hashtags, this is where, and I think you were doing some research on this again because you were trying to deal with the cultural / racial sort of elements within Twitter to see if there was any significant difference between what the trending topics were. So the hashtags, the top one was Remember When. The second one was Slap Yourself. Third one was Confession Time. Fourth one is Things I Miss. Fifth one was Oh, Just Like Me. Sixth was When I Was Little. 7 was Have You Ever. 8 was I Can't Live Without. 9 was Thankful. And 10 was 2010 Disappointments. I can list a million. Number 10 should be number 1. 2010 Disappointments. My life. The life that... Everyone surrounding my life, everything and everyone disappointed me this year. So but what's interesting also with these hashtags, a lot of it is just sort of feeling out for if anyone else out there feels the same way you do, which is an interesting sort of concept. It's something that you see actually on 4chan often. The anonymous random group / B, if you go on there, a lot of these are similar. You know, people will post Remember Wins. Of course, when they do that, it's often filthy. So I don't recommend children going there. But It's an interesting thing. Twitter, I think, is superior. Now, you and I just joined Diaspora, and I don't know what the future of that will be, as it's an alpha right now, but it's an interesting concept. I kind of like some of the elements they have going with it.
Yeah, the big worry is that, and I've been involved in some discussion about this, with Diaspora, that the value of it requires you to intellectualize your social network use.
Yeah.
If you're going to sell it to somebody, you have to sell it based on the idea of their aspects, where what they really highlight is that when you blast out content, you get to choose precisely who's viewing it.
Yep.
And then you, all that data is stored on your computer server side when it gets finally launched, and therefore you can take that data away, and it's never owned by anyone. That
is great.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's precisely what I want, but selling that to your 60-year-old mom,
it'll never happen.
Is impossible. They're going to say, I don't care. You know, when, all that heat about Zuckerberg and Facebook appeared, and it was made blatantly obvious to everyone that Zuckerberg is a piece of shit and that Facebook is dedicated to taking advantage of you at every moment for profit, people still said, who cares?
Isn't that symptomatic of our country right now? I mean, honestly, everyone is so lethargic and not responsive to what's happening around them at all. They want to just have this glazed over life where they don't have to evaluate things much deeper than at a surface level. But if they actually gave a cursory glance to shit, I think they would get fucking pissed. Like, they should be pissed about the tax shit, and they should be pissed that somebody is mishandling what they consider to be private sort of information. I don't get why people don't get fired up.
Yeah, but then, you know, the Obama administration passes health care, which helps everyone, and yet that's what they get fired up about. I mean, it boggles the mind.
It's all antithetical to what we believe here on the podcast. It's nothing. That's why 2010 is also a disappointment. I mean, counting down from 2006, you know, 2005, the last great year, that's going to be the new book by Tanner and I. It's going to highlight the best events of our life that happened up to 2005. And then the last, the epilogue will be how 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10, and surely 11, 12, 13 until we die, which will probably be sometime in the teens. Until we die. It's just been one disappointment after another. In the culture vulture world, I only like real friends. This game's no EverQuest. I only fly first class. Culture vulture world. My Green Lantern comic collection remains unsold. I think that movie rules. That writer's such a dude. Culture vulture burst. George Lucas fucked my youth. Back with culture, and Chris, you had something you wanted to talk about in relation to Teen Wolf. Yeah, well, it's been the, I don't know what you want to call that thing at the top of the show, the zinger, the opener, whatever it is, but I was brought, this was brought to my attention from friend of the show, Casey. If you go, it's also streaming on Netflix, but if you have the DVD, you can do this also. If you go to the 1 hour, 28 minute and 50 second mark of Teen Wolf and hit play, Tanner, I think you've got it queued up right now.
Okay.
Okay. I want you to look at the man and the bleachers to the left of Michael J. Fox's dad and tell me what his pants are doing.
God.
Keep watching.
Holy crap.
Now, Casey thinks that there's a dick being shown. I'm not sure.
No, there is most certainly a dick. And if it's not a dick, what we have here is a man in skinny jeans in very hardcore hipster fashion.
Yeah.
the height of hipster fashion right now this guy is embodying. And this is the celebration scene at the end of Teen Wolf. And
it's
what
huge.
I saw was a man in skinny jeans who's only shot from the waist down with his dick hanging out of his pants, and then he tucks it back in.
He tucks it back in. I'm watching it again. Michael J. Fox is writhing on his dad's crotch, like, as this is happening. they're celebrating. He's sort of like being put up and down, like he's having sex with his dad. And meanwhile, in the background, this guy is zipping up, tucking away, just sort of nonchalantly, like, ho hum, here's my dick.
And he looks to be at half mast, as if while Michael J was in his wolf form, he was fully erect, and then afterwards, it
sort
kind of turned him off. Yeah, he was
yeah.
a little bit disappointed.
Like, oh, Scott stopped being the wolf, you know. It's pretty crazy that actually got through. Like, I'm sure there are alternate takes of that scene. It surely wasn't done in one take.
And
that dude's dick is pointed to the right, the left for the viewer, but to his right.
There's no way the director and editor couldn't have caught that. It is so obvious.
It's crazy. I never saw it, though. I was always so focused on Booth that I couldn't. That's not true. I never liked the move. But I was always so focused on sort of what was going on. There's this commotion, there's a ruckus, but there's this lone wolf just sitting there, standing there in the bleachers, decides not to come down, has too much business to take care of with his Dizak. I thought it was great.
Epic troll.
Yeah. All right. What are we doing today? What do we got on the slate?
So I finally feel prepared to talk about Sufjan Stevens' full-length LP release, The Age of Odds, which came out in October, and we really didn't talk about it at all, which is surprising given I think he's probably the most brilliant person working in music right now. But the album, which followed the EP, which we did review, All Delightful People, which came out, I think, a month prior to this.
Yeah, I think so.
And both were totally under wraps and just appeared out of nowhere with no promotion at all. They just emerged in a period where a lot of people thought that he had kind of fallen off the map. And we now know he had some kind of really awful illness that is shrouded in mystery.
I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah, apparently he's recovered from it, but he had some debilitating, and Wikipedia says debilitating viral infection that affected his nervous system.
Oh, my God.
With chronic pain, and he had to stop working for a while. We don't know what it was.
HIV.
Yeah, could be. I mean, he's awfully private.
Which they cured, apparently, but that'll be a news story for another day.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that. It was great.
Yeah. So this album came out in October. I waited to get it at the concert. I saw this album essentially performed in nearly its entirety in concert and got it there and have been listening to it since and finally feel prepared to talk about it because this is a difficult album. This is something that you'll listen to initially and just won't understand. It's seemingly incoherent in a way. And it's 11 tracks with some long songs culminating in the final track at 25 minutes in length.
Jesus Christ.
So just even digesting the final track is incredibly difficult. But I would encourage people because I feel like this album hasn't had the focus that it should have had.
From listeners or from Sufjan?
I think the press in a way.
Okay.
I think it got attention at release, but hasn't had the attention that it really deserves. Pitchfork just named it its 25th best album of the year, and it got good critical reception, but I feel like a lot of listeners probably encountered it and then probably went away from it and found it to be a little unwelcoming in a way. And I think that's really unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
What I will say about this album is that I think it's his second best album ever, which is incredibly high praise given my first best album of his, Illinois, is in my top five albums of all time. And I feel very confident in saying this is his second best album ever, and there's no hesitation about that. All 11 tracks are great. There's no duds whatsoever. And they're all really, really dense and complex. This marks a big change from his old albums, in that he did a lot of electronic stuff in the past, but never really released that in a large format. And he's been mostly identified as a folk musician that got more and more orchestral over time. This album strips everything down, is very heavily electronic with some folk moments. And he said at the concert that what he did was he changed his songwriting process to where he just experimented with sound, created new sounds, started putting them together. And then once that kind of composition was made, then he layered a song on top of them. So it's reversed his whole process. And what results is, instead of the narratives of the past, say embodied in a song like John Wayne Gacy, which if you're familiar with him, you'll be familiar with that
song. Amazing song.
Amazing song with a kind of narrative to it. That isn't present here. What you have here is sort of meditations on ideas and kind of soul searching and some really deep shit where you get more of a feeling of who he is and what he's struggling with. And the album is really conceptual in that it uses the artwork of this guy named Royal Robertson, who was a self-proclaimed prophet and preacher in the Deep South, who was also schizophrenic. And his religious devotion and his schizophrenia started to merge together to where it was kind of indistinguishable from each other. And he created paintings about these prophecies he had and visions he had about the world. So Sufjan uses that as inspiration for this album. And it's very clear that he feels some affinity with that idea of schizophrenia and madness, as well as religious devotion. And there's a lot of stuff about lost romance and failed relationships here and redemption and all of that. It's all being struggled with here in a far more invigorating way than in his other albums. And during the concert, which was essentially a performance art piece, it was everyone sat down, you had assigned seats, and it had a lot of visual material, choreography. In the middle of that, he got up and he just explained for probably 15 to 20 minutes how he sees this album, what it means to him, what Royal Robertson means to him. And what was really peculiar about it was people were laughing. Because he's like, yeah, Royal Robertson did this, and he was a really amazing artist, and he had, you know, he's all this thing. And then he's like, he had these visions of the future and all this shit coming down, and he was also schizophrenic. And people were like, ha ha ha. And it just showed like hipsters are fucking morons. Like it wasn't a funny moment. He was saying this is really tragic. And I could tell, and the person I was with could tell, that he identified with that mental condition, because it's mm-hmm. clear, I think, that he's struggling with his religiosity. And it was a very bizarre moment where he's like kind of revealing himself to people and then they're laughing.
I'd quit on the spot if I realized all my fans were shitheads.
Apparently he does this every show, and probably the first few shows it was odd, but I think he was probably used to it by our show, that people found this funny. But there's, I mean, it's really profound. And when you start to really dig into the album and let it work its magic on you, you start to see those parallels where he's, I mean, there's some really serious shit going on in this album. So, I mean, there's some really standout songs here that are also, I think, really accessible to old fans. So something like Futile Devices or Vesuvius or I Walked are places I would suggest you go first to get into the album and see that, yes, there are some things that you can kind of hook into as singles. But then the other songs that at first you might find incomprehensible, if you just let them, you know, give them a few listens, give them a few casual listens, it'll start to unravel itself as just incredible stuff going on, especially that final 25-minute song. I mean, how many fucking people working in music today can create a 25-minute song that you just – you don't want to leave when it starts? Mm. It's just brilliant shit. This album is fucking amazing. I'm going to spoil it now. We're going to do our New Year's show. This is my album of the year. It destroys High Violet, okay? It is, I mean, it is just incredible stuff. And it's just not getting the attention it deserves. So if you got it and you let it go, or if you never got around to it, get it and listen to it. It really, really deserves your attention. So it's a clear A+ for me.
Well, if that's an A+, then what's Illinois?
A+ as well. I mean,
I'm just curious. You said one and two. I'm just wondering if there's a, you know, if there's an A++ in this bullshit scale you're just proposing all the
time. I think that, you know, the difference here between this album and Illinois is that Illinois is just, I think it to me, it's like that moment in every artist's career where they achieve something that is seemingly unachievable. Like Illinois has this brilliance in melody and in arrangement that is just like a once in a lifetime kind of thing. You know, this album is fucking great. Is what very few artists will ever get an album as good as Age of Odds. But Illinois is in the pantheon of great albums of all time. So they're both A pluses, but Illinois is a top five album of all time. I mean, if someone listened to Illinois and said they didn't like it, I would stop talking to them. You know, it's like one of those.
You know, right. It's a character flaw. It's not it's not a decision.
You know, we're both obsessed with Bottle Rocket, and it's one of those things where if I'm having a conversation, this has happened with a few different people. If I'm having a conversation with someone and we start talking about Bottle Rocket and they say they like Bottle Rocket, I'll automatically make an effort to be friends with that person.
Right.
Because you know that they have a sort of extraordinary taste that is rare.
Yeah, it's the ultimate litmus test to figure out who's a douche and who's, you know, a stand-up person who understands your mental processes, I think.
I think it also shows that we're very twisted in a high fidelity sort of way.
It's true. I mean, we have our things. But what I'm interested in, I'm curious, you know, because Sufjan definitely is, or however you say it, it's definitely he's in a tumultuous period. It sounds like with this whole Royal Robertson stuff and exploring his faith. And I'm actually that makes him much more interesting. I love backstories to albums, so I'm glad that he's telling it. Because it actually adds much more to it. Otherwise, I might look at this because I haven't heard anything off of this album. I didn't buy it, and it's not on purpose. It's just I totally forgot, to be honest. But when
which
I
is
see
why it, I'm why I'm calling attention to because I do think people just sort of forgot it happened.
Well, you know, I sort of forgot because All Delighted People came out and I was satisfied. It satiated my thirst for his music and I was fine. And it just sort of slipped through the cracks for me that this that the actual product of his labor came out. And but I'm always one who likes process, and so I like that he's explaining this stuff. Because otherwise, I'd look at this and I'd see a 25-minute song and go, well, he's full of himself if he thinks he's gonna make me listen for 25 fucking minutes to one track. I mean, Typo Negative gets me to listen for about 12 minutes. That's about tops. Broken Social Scene can handle something about 12 minutes long too. But then beyond that, it starts to get a bit self-indulgent, I would think.
Yeah, see that. I mean. But that's the brilliance about that song is that it doesn't drag. Like it's like an opera. You know, it has its moments, and when he played that song live, it had a performance to it. Like, he had some female singers, and there was like a dialogue between him and them, and then the group transformed, and there was this redemptive celebratory moment at the end. I mean, it's just the shit he's doing is on an intellectual level that's so beyond everyone else working. It's incredible.
As you're describing this, I'm thinking of, in a different medium, of course, but like director Paul Thomas Anderson, who you and I had been talking. We've been doing that that movie rating website. I forget what it's called now, but
Flickchart.com,
and we the battle came up between Boogie Nights and Magnolia, and in the discussion we were having, I was thinking about how. Paul Thomas Anderson has come out and said that he'll never make a movie like Magnolia ever again. And it happened for him in sort of a tumultuous period in his life. He didn't think he was ever going to best Boogie Nights. And he wrote this movie over the course of several weeks, you know, all by himself, brought out all these characters, all this stuff, this whole process went into it. And it's a movie now that people don't necessarily examine closer. And for me, I think the reason why I put Magnolia at the top of his game is because I also factor in what went into it from his perspective. I like to know that he poured everything that he had at that moment in his life went into that movie. And in retrospect, he looks at it and he thinks, I'll never top that. And yet people look at his catalog of movies and they say, well, he's made better movies. But I like that he likes it so much, and I love the movie. I mean, in general, I love the movie anyway. But so I think like maybe Sufjan's at that point in his career now where he's like very reflective, and he's seeing that he's accomplished a lot. But here's an album that maybe he might even think to himself, I can't top this, and maybe it's because there's so much upheaval going on in his own brain. I mean, I in his case, I not to say anything bad about Paul Thomas Anderson, but because they're different mediums, I think Sufjan is just sort of a rising star that will never be stopped. I sort of think the same way about Paul Thomas Anderson, but at the same time, there's this part of me that thinks that P.T. Anderson will at some point have an idea similar to like Punch Drunk Love, where it's like, it's a good movie, but it's not great. It's not on par with his best. I think Sufjan, though, is like destined to become a modern day composer of sorts who is actually, you know, selling out the Philharmonic so he can showcase his new shit. You know what I mean? He has a lot of different options as far as his style and variation in musical instruments and shit like that, that I think are not quite there for directors.
Yeah, he's a super, you know, Sufjan is just a super genius of musicality. And listening to this album, like I was just listening to it before we started the show. If you get a good pair of headphones on and you just sit there, it's so dense. There's so many little pieces floating in the background that you just pass over. But if you really intently focus, you can see the intense craft employed in the music that just does. I mean, when you look at shit that's nominated for Grammys and stuff, it's it's not labored over.
It's a farce.
I think that's a really great analogy, though, between P.T. Anderson and Sufjan. I think they were at the same period. You know, Boogie Nights and Illinois are like the same kind of thing. I think they were both at that same crossroads.
Because how do you top it? How do you come back from something like that? It's like if even you think you peaked and then suddenly you came out with something so intense and you're wondering why other people maybe aren't finding it as intense as you, and you have to sit there and explain it for 30 minutes at a show so people get it. You know, it's like, you know, there's something going on in his brain where he's like, you have to love this. I love it so much.
Yeah.
Why don't you?
The one last little comment. When I went to the concert, I was initially, the person I was in it with was initially very pissed off because we were watching the show and it seemed like he was lip syncing. And I started to get really pissed off because clearly he had put a lot of effort into creating this performance piece. And I was like, God damn it. But if you're going to do that at the cost of singing live, what the, you know, what the fuck? I'm here to hear you sing. That's what I paid for. And I started getting really pissed. And this lasted for about half of the show. And then there were moments where he changed things up or laughed or kind of screwed up. And it was revealed that he was singing live.
He's an angel. And like, he's a cherub.
I was like, my mind imploded. I have never, and I've been to a lot of concerts. I've never heard someone's voice sound that perfect. I mean, it's like, it was, he's an amazing composer of music, but then his voice is damn near unparalleled.
Yeah.
And so if you get a chance to see him live, it's enough to just marvel at how incredible his voice is. All right, we'll be back with Wildcard. Last week we did a time trial on pro wrestling, and when the 10-minute timer stopped, I think we were both really, really disappointed because wrestling, there's so much to say about it that talking for 10 minutes just barely scratches the surface. So we decided to continue that discussion about pro wrestling this week and get into more of our reminiscences about how it's affected our life and what we think about it. Last week, it was dominated by the realization of the intensely homoerotic nature, which is so fucking true. And it's so funny that the normal viewer of wrestling, I think, totally disavows that connection and doesn't really realize that it's there. But it is the most homoerotic of all sports, I think. Absolutely. We'll set another 10 minutes and just go off. So you made a list.
It's so piecemeal. it's not even a it's okay. Well, I mean, the first thing I wrote down on my list was a type of wrestling match that I loved. I fucking love these. And I you know, there's all sorts of, you know, sort of gimmick matches that come up, but I loved the steel cage match.
Oh yeah.
So much. I'll never forget seeing Big Boss Man. Who was he fighting in that? It was like Big Boss Man versus like the Ultimate Warrior or something in a steel cage match. And it was just such a great idea for a match where everything is so clearly staged. But for us, it was amazing to see these guys, you know, climb to the top of the cage and they jump, you know, 14 feet down. It was just crazy shit.
Yeah, and the idea was that it eliminated all that outside of the ring tomfoolery and just
yeah.
Two men locked in this cage. We will see who the ultimate victor is.
Yeah. Although sometimes there would be somebody who would come in with like cutters to get through the chain links to get in the fence, you know, some shit like that. But, and there was those kinds of matches. There was also, and this wasn't heavily used in the WWF, but it was definitely in the WCW, the lumberjack match. Do you remember those?
Yeah. With the ladder, right? Was that what?
Oh, no. Actually, no. The lumberjack match was where they would surround the ring with other wrestlers. And if another wrestler got thrown out, the other wrestlers would beat the shit out of the wrestler who was thrown out of the ring.
So it was like a sea of piranha.
Yeah, and it avoided the whole, you know, the 10 count out of the ring or any sort of shenanigans happening. Well, actually, no, it didn't prevent the shenanigans. In fact, it encouraged shenanigans because then what would happen is somebody would get thrown out and then the bad people who hated that person would all surround them and do something, you know, that was bad, you know. But they would have there's just also – or like special referee matches where they would have a guest referee come in and they would sometimes fuck things up for the whole thing.
You're negating the Royal Rumble.
No, I didn't negate that. See, I included that under events. That's another category here.
See, okay, the downfall of the Royal Rumble, though, is first of all, it was always like pleasure overload seeing all the wrestlers and they'd all square off. But the problem was what it devolved into is just a bunch of guys grabbing on and hammering on each other's heads.
Yeah, in a corner and then like running or walking to the next guy and everyone's just panting and
there were no moves being employed. It was just a bunch of people hammering at each other and then all of a sudden someone get tossed out.
Well, the best part about two best things about the Royal Rumble was number one, it began with sort of like a lottery. So you would have your favorites, but you didn't know what when they were going to actually enter the ring. And I think they have up to, I don't know, like 10 or 30. I don't know how many guys end up being, at least at its max capacity, could potentially be in the ring, pending one of them being thrown out before everyone gets in. But at some point, the guy who gets the last number, of course, you know, the last one in the ring has the best chance of winning the whole thing. The guy who's first in has to be, you know, it's a test of endurance and willpower. But in this fake sport I'm talking about. But the best part was when a guy would come running into the ring and everyone's cheering, and somebody would throw him out immediately. Like, somebody would do a quick, like, toss over the ropes as he was running towards
them. Some guy would be overhyped, would run in and immediately get the quick exit, and then would be shocked as he's outside.
Or they'd jump in and immediately get a kick to the head. Like, there's... They didn't even stand a chance. I loved the Royal Rumble. There's so many different types of matches. There's the ones where, like, they would have, I remember the Undertaker would have those, like, casket matches or whatever. But they would also have where somebody has to retire. If they lose, they're forced into retirement. So stupid.
What was your opinion, though, on the extreme matches? Because I feel like they kind of ruined the sport in a way. When suddenly you had barbed wire and tacks, there was no artfulness to it. It became just about pain endurance, right. And that just it the effective atmosphere of wrestling was altered, and I think negatively.
I think that was actually sort of what marked a change. If you want to, I think that they already have eras for wrestling. I don't know what they are. But for me, I guess golden era, I know for older people, that might be like the 70s or whatever with different wrestlers. But for me, the golden era is probably like the 80s through the early 90s. And then maybe the silver age would be the 90s up until the NWO. And then around that time, it's not that they were losing. Well, they were losing, I think, some of their fan base at some point, and this hardcore wrestling sort of style, whatever, I can't remember the name of the organization.
ECW.
The ECW, that's right. I they sort of stepped it up a notch, and it was almost around the same time that Ultimate Fighting was coming around, and it might have been a reaction to losing fan base to real fighting.
Yeah.
So... I'm not sure about this, to be honest.
Well, no, around the time where there was a lot of backlash about, well, wrestling isn't real. So they felt like they had to compensate for that by making it more real, when actually the beauty of it was that it wasn't real. Like, they totally fucked up the formula.
Yeah. And that sort of led way to why to the new era of wrestling that I'm just so not interested in. You know, there's still the hokiness involved and everything, but I think once they tried to actually make wrestling real, for me it had the exact opposite effect, which was I'm totally not interested in somebody, you know, jumping into spikes or whatever it is that they've got, you know, the blood and all that stuff. It's interesting, I suppose, but it's like once you become desensitized to that, there's nothing to it. You know, in wrestling, it wasn't – the blood was saved for the pay-per-view events, and it was obviously to get your money. But, I mean, that meant – every so often – that meant that it was a treat when every so often somebody's head split open when it wasn't WrestleMania. It made it an event in and of itself. It was a spectacle. Once everyone's bleeding, it's like, well, what else is that? Where, you know, that's the apex. Unless you're going to actually start mutilating or killing somebody, which I'm not really interested in it at all. That's it. So, I don't know. I mean, that was sort of the death knell, I think, for me. I think around that time, but
yeah, it's when I lost interest in it too. I think they've done away with it a lot. I think it's more into the sensationalistic style now, but I haven't really seen much of it. Now, my question for you. What was your favorite wrestler?
I had that question for you too. Now, okay, this changed over time, obviously. Early on, I had no idea why I liked certain wrestlers. I just liked them. Usually it's because they had a chocolate-colored skin, or perhaps they perhaps they wore outrageous outfits. So early on, I remember Coco Beware getting my attention.
Yeah, with the parrot. What a gimmick.
Yeah, he would come out with a parrot and flap his arms around, but he wore like neon green shit all over his black body. And that was just but again, this goes back to like, there's no good reason why anyone likes a wrestler. It's usually something very superficial like that.
Yeah, it's about style. I mean, because like, I loved the style of Legion of Doom. Like, I loved the shoulder pads with the spikes. Like, and it was just, it wasn't overly done. It was just hardcore.
Yeah, well, Legion of Doom was actually, like, what was great about them was their, yeah, it was hardcore, and there was something, but this, again, goes back to a matter of whether or not this synced up with my vision of what tough was, and they fit the vision perfectly, and I remember always having that hypothetical, because back then, you know, there was WWF, WCW, the hypothetical was, how would Legion of Doom do in the WWF? Before they came over anyway to the WWF. But so I liked them. I'm trying to think. Of course, I fell into the Hulk Hogan trap. And especially
I never did. I never liked Hulk. And so when Ultimate Warrior came about and was battling with Hulk, I was all Ultimate Warrior.
Well, I became an Ultimate Warrior fan around the time. Well, I think I was already a fan, but when they did a WrestleMania that was in Toronto, it was like WrestleMania 7, I think. I can't remember. But they did the Ultimate Warrior beat Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania, and that's when it sort of solidified that he was a bigger badass to me.
Well, the minute I saw him and how ripped he was, I already knew he was a bigger badass.
Yeah, well, and again, it comes back to muscular definition over anything else. I'm trying to think.
I'll tell you who my favorite wrestler of all time was Shawn Michaels, who. And I can see why he appealed to me now, because I'm so interested in gender and personality and comedy. And he had all those aspects. Like, he was playing with gender and making guys kind of feel uncomfortable because he was like the sexy boy and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But then, he had the good body as well. But then he was also really funny, like actually funny. And on top of, he was really, when you look at it, one of the best skilled wrestlers. Like, yeah, he was actually a good, he could do moves really well and transition really well and could sell things really well. So by far he was my favorite of all time, I think.
I was a huge fan of all, you know, I don't think I had many WCW guys that I liked. I can't even think of too many.
I fell into the Sting thing when he turned into the Crow.
Yeah, and see, yeah. Turned into the Crow. It's true. That's exactly what he was. There was no mistaking that. Actually, and I was wrong, by the way. Hulk Hogan and Ultimate Warrior squared off just after WrestleMania 7. It was at SummerSlam 1991. I was close, though. There was also Survivor Series. That was also another event that they used to do. But this just brings it up to me, by the way. Do you remember, and this is how relevant it was back in the day, do you remember when Sergeant Slaughter began... he was a huge guy for all of us kids because he was a G.I. Joe, which meant he was all American.
Yeah, he crossed over. Like, he materialized out of the cartoon.
Yeah. he would come in waving an Iraqi flag. This is in the midst of Desert Storm.
It was so brilliant.
Oh my God.
People got so fucking pissed. It was just so brilliant. I could see McMahon sitting at a table being like, let's just fuck with people.
Yeah, it's just fucking crazy.
Let's build up icons and tear them down.
But I think if I have to go with who was I the biggest fan of for the longest amount of time, it was The Undertaker. I was a huge fan of his for many years. So I think he had
probably in the history of wrestling, probably the best gimmick.
I think. Yeah. And what's weird is I knew that before that he was I can't remember what his name was in WCW, but he would walk the top rope and then punch somebody's arm. That was his end move. It was so stupid. Yeah. But I can't remember who he was before that. But I'll see if I can find it. But yeah, no, it's but like everything about the Undertaker, he's from Death Valley. He had what was the guy's, Paul Bearer was his guy, you know.
And they had great talk ups to the matches because they would be like in some graveyard.
Yeah. Oh, the Ultimate Warrior. And speaking of talk-ups, it reminded me, do you remember, what was the, Brother Love, wasn't that his name? Where he'd come out and his face beat red and be like, I love you. And it was great because he was always asking for it, and it was just a matter of time before someone beat his ass on the set of his own show.
WWF was every possible gimmick was used. I mean, there was the dentist guy. There was the released inmate, the genius, the repo man. Like
every profession at some point was you know, they tackled the issues. But who was your favorite wrestler then of all time though?
No, Shawn Michaels was
Shawn Michaels of all time. Okay.
And I began obsessing over people with good bodies who seemed tough and that kind of shit. So like I began liking Legion of Doom or Ultimate Warrior. But then over time, I started becoming the discerning wrestling. You know, there was this idea that some wrestlers were more skilled than others. You know, Ultimate Warrior is a hack, but fucking Bret Hart was, yeah. I forget what the term they'd use. They'd say he's like good tactically or something.
Yeah.
Or they had
he's
some
a specialist.
They had some term to make up for like his diminutive size by saying, well, Bret Hart is, you know, he has tactical advantage. He's really a skilled wrestler in the ring. So I began believing into this line of bullshit and being like, well, these wrestlers are the ones that really wrestle. You know, these other guys don't. When really, it's all about fucking personality.
Yeah, exactly. Now, do you remember? Okay, what about and this is something I don't think they utilize anymore. In fact, I think it's just sort of a mishmash. But tag teams and even like the triple tag teams that would come out. Like if you remember, like the there was the what are they called? The Rock and Roll Express.
Yeah.
What was that?
The Nasty Boys.
The Nasty Boys, Demolition, the Brain Busters.
Oh, Demolition, yep.
Yeah, the Hart Foundation.
The Hart Foundation with the guy that looked like ZZ Top with a beer belly.
Yeah. Even Legion of Doom. And I think at one point Legion of Doom had three guys. They had Hawk, Animal, and somebody else I think they brought in. The Natural Disasters with Earthquake and Typhoon, which...
Typhoon or Tugboat, remember?
Yeah, Tugboat Thomas. He would do like a toot-toot with him before he did it.
His costume looked like the costume they have at Walmart when you take your 5-year-old son to get a picture. the little sailor.
Yeah. The Steiners, remember the Steiners? They were huge.
Oh yeah. And they were from Michigan.
Yeah, they're all about Michigan, which made it all about, you know, we love that shit. And they had the Frankensteiner, which was a pretty badass, like, tag team move to do, where one guy would hold the guy on his shoulders and the other guy would jump off the top rope and scissor around his neck and then flip him. It was pretty incredible. But do you remember, just going back to the Natural Disasters, Earthquake, how he got his start? If you remember, I think it was either a regular Monday night event or whatever, or a WrestleMania, but Dino Bravo was trying to, in a show of his ability to be tough and strong, he called out what was considered a random person from the audience, which turned out to be Earthquake, and he said that he could do a push-up with him sitting on his back. And so Earthquake came to the ring, this guy who was not, you know, he wasn't a big star at the time. And then he did the push up with him on his back. And that indicated how tough he was. I don't know if you remember that. I don't know why I remember that shit.
What gets to the point where one of the fascinating things about wrestlers was clearly they would recruit people who the management felt like could be successful wrestlers. But then they would get introduced with gimmicks that didn't take off. So I remember The Rock first was introduced as this douchey character, Rocky Maivia.
Wasn't his dad a wrestler?
He was like the next generation. And he had no personality and he was just the good guy. That didn't work. He gets reborn as The Rock and suddenly that works. And this would happen. And fans were fine with this. Like they were fine with a wrestler whose persona got recreated, which is just... fascinating to think about that. It's not the person, it's the performance is what connects with the audience. Well, we gotta stop though.
Just think as a good case study for that is like someone like Stone Cold Steve Austin, who was stunning Steve Austin and then went to Stone Cold
And then that's when his life took off after that. I mean, he was the biggest star, I think, in all of wrestling because he had this no-nonsense, I'm a badass attitude.
Mm-hmm.
I can talk about this still. We need to revisit this again. I still have more things on my list, including we still haven't talked about the NWO and the crossover and how that was played in and how genius that was.
Yeah, shit
like that.
If you have thoughts about wrestling, email them to allcapspodcast@gmail.com. Go to www.allcapspodcast.com. Go to iTunes, subscribe, post a written review. And our next show will be the live show on December 3rd. I'm not sure when it'll get released because I don't think I'm going to be able to edit it at home. So it probably won't come out until the 28th or 29th. So we're going to take.
What sort of star power are we looking at for this episode? I mean,
Zalman King was confirmed. Director of the Red Shoe Diaries.
I talked to Michael J. Fox's people, and I couldn't get him. But I was able to get an impersonator, Michael K. Pax, which is just Kevin Spacey playing his role but with Parkinson's.
Just as good, if you ask me.
I think so. And Prince Capsian will not be there. I just got word from his people.
We will be having the Jeff Goldblum Film Fest. including a culmination with Transylvania 65,000.
This is star-studded. Well, actually, the people we contacted would have made this star-studded, but because they won't come, it's now less of a star-studded event. But it's still going to be fun.
All right, so we'll see you in 10 days or so.
Yep. Bye. I'm not your boy toy. I'm just a sexy boy. I'm not your boy toy. I make him hot. I make him shiver. Their knees get weak whenever I'm around. They see me walk. They hear me talk. I make them feel like they're on cloud nine. I'm just a sexy boy. I'm not your boy toy. I'm just a sexy boy. I'm not your boy toy. Eat your heart out, girl. Hands off the merchandise.